September 17th, 2000, 4 p.m. at the Westport, the luxuriant Westport. 3 years of no severe flooding find the willows crowding the banks of these clear, gentle waters. A line of quail, a dozen, snakes up the cliff, unaware of our presence. The bottomland thrives on this drought. Listen. Listen now to the gentle whisper as we sit right here on a log, lower half of a dismembered frog, drying in the sun, right next to us, right here in the middle of the Westport of the mighty Gila. Oh, we live in a mythic time. We live in a time when people's hearts are beginning to open to the needs of other species. We are beginning to step aside just a little to make room, corners here and there as yet, for all creatures to maintain a presence on this planet. Even those creatures who provide us no flesh to hunt, no sport at the end of a fish line. Indeed, even those creatures who are a bit inconvenient to live with. We live in a mythic place. This is the landscape in which the Mexican gray wolf has been welcomed back to its home. This is a creature who for generations has known nothing of the wild. Yet here we are, right here and now, helping this proud subspecies remember its wild ways. Surely we and they will fumble in these early stages, but the journey has begun. These thoughts occurred to me just yesterday evening. I climbed up the arroyo out of the canyon, as I often do, to admire the not-so-distant plume of a good ground fire in the wilderness, to watch the sun set through smoky haze, and to enjoy the antics of our local crew of vultures, playing and socializing on wing, as they do every evening, converging just here for miles and miles around. I descended via an unmarked trail, and while walking home along the road, came upon two neighbors out for an evening walk. We stopped and talked about our hopes and dreams for the well-being of the wolves. More, we talked about what the return of the wolf symbolizes about us, about these times, and the growing generosity of our culture. We also shared our despair, our worries that somehow this will all come to naught, that those of us who live in Grant and Catron counties may not be quite generous enough in giving the wolves the chance they deserve to relearn wariness and skill. I told my neighbors that more than once this summer, I had turned to a mythic story to counter my despair, to enhance my resolve. Like so many others I have talked with, anti as well as pro-wolf, these friends had only a vague awareness of this particular story. Although the essay takes perhaps 4 minutes to read, they had not done so. They had never read the story that is known throughout the nation, indeed, in much of the world, as marking the spiritual transformation of one of the greatest conservationists of all time. This is the man who envisioned the Gila Wilderness, the first designated wilderness in the entire world. This is the man whose name now graces the adjacent wilderness of the Black Range. This is Aldo Leopold. Leopold's essay is Thinking Like a Mountain. It appears in his collection of essays, A Sand County Almanac, whose 50th year of publication we celebrated last year, along with the 75th anniversary of the Gila Wilderness. The essay begins, a deep, chesty bawl echoes from rimrock to rimrock, rolls down the mountain, and fades into the far blackness of the night. He goes on to recount a pack trip on patrol for the Forest Service in the Gila and Blue Range country, when he and his partner came upon a wolf and her pups. Like all good forest rangers of the time, the duo pumped lead into the pack. The she-wolf was still alive when they approached. Leopold wrote, "We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain." Leopold continues, "I was young then, and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view." This little extract cannot do the story justice, but perhaps it is enough to prompt some readers to seek out this part of our heritage. Maybe it will inspire a few to begin telling the story and retelling the story. We can argue till we are blue in the face, but a story, a mythic story, can impart so much more. We live in a mythic time. We live in a mythic place. 50 years hence, Americans surely will still be savoring the story of the fierce green fire. In our zeal to help the wolves and argue on their behalf, let us not forget the power of the story. Let us not forget to tell the old stories and to begin creating mythic stories of our own. A deep, chesty bawl echoes from rimrock to rimrock, rolls down the mountain, and fades into the far blackness of the night. It is an outburst of vile, defiant sorrow, and of contempt for all the adversities of the world. Every living thing, and perhaps many a dead one as well, pays heed to that call. To the deer, it is a reminder of the way of all flesh. To the pine, a forecast of midnight scuffles and the blood upon the snow. To the coyote, promise of gleanings to come. To the cowman, a threat of red ink at the bank. To the hunter, a challenge of fang against bullet. Yet behind these obvious and immediate hopes and fears, there lies a deeper meaning, known only to the mountain itself. Only the mountain has lived long enough to listen objectively to the howl of a wolf. Those unable to decipher the hidden meaning know nevertheless that it is there, for it is felt in all wolf country and distinguishes that country from all other lands. It tingles in the spine of all who hear wolves by night or who scan their tracks by day. Even without sight or sound of a wolf, it is implicit. It is implicit in a hundred small events. The midnight whinny of a pack horse, the rattle of rolling rocks, the bound of a fleeing deer, the way shadows lie under the spruces. Only the ineducable tyro can fail to sense the presence or absence of wolves, or the fact that mountains have a secret opinion about them. My own conviction on this score dates from the day I saw a wolf die. We were eating lunch on a high rim rock, at the foot of which a turbulent river elbowed its way. We saw what we thought was a doe fording the torrent, her breast awash in white water. When she climbed the bank toward us and shook out her tail, we realized our error. It was a wolf. A half dozen others, evidently grown pups, sprang from the willows and all joined in a welcoming melee of wagging tails and playful maulings. What was literally a pile of wolves writhed and tumbled in the center of an open flat at the foot of our rim rock. In those days, we had never heard of passing up a chance to kill a wolf. In a second, we were pumping lead into the pack, but with more excitement than accuracy. How to aim a steep downhill shot is always confusing. When our rifles were empty, the old wolf was down, and a pup was dragging the leg into impassable slide rocks. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in their eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those mountains, something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then, and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed. Since then, I have lived to see state after state extirpate its wolves. I've watched the face of many a newly wolfless mountain and seen the south-facing slopes wrinkle with a maze of new deer trails. I have seen every edible bush and seedling browsed, first to anemic desuetude and then to death. I have seen every edible tree defoliated to the height of a saddle horn Such a mountain looks as if someone had given God the new pruning shears and forbidden him all other exercise. In the end, the starved bones of the hoped-for deer herd, dead of its own too much, bleach with the bones of the dead sage, or molder under the high-lying junipers. I now suspect that just as the deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer. And perhaps with better cause. For while a buck pulled down by wolves can be replaced in 2 or 3 years, a range pulled down by too many deer may fail of replacement in as many decades. So also with cows. The cowman who cleans his range of wolves does not realize that he is taking over the wolf's job of trimming the herd to fit the range. He has not learned to think like a mountain. Hence, we have dust bowls and rivers washing the future into the sea. We all strive for safety, prosperity, comfort, long life, and dullness. The deer strives with his supple legs, the cowman with trap and poison, the statesman with pen, the most of us with machines, votes, and dollars. But it all comes down to the same thing. Peace in our time. A measure of success in this is all well enough, and perhaps is a requisite to objective thinking. But too much safety seems to yield only danger in the long run. Perhaps this is behind Thoreau's dictum. In wildness is the salvation of the world. Perhaps this is the hidden meaning in the howl of the wolf, long known among mountains, but seldom perceived among humans. I like to be around trees who remember. Trees who remember a time I cannot. It is comforting for me to visit a rare grove of 200-year-old white pines in central Michigan. These pines were here when my paternal ancestors made the land between the Great Lakes their home. Encircled by a moat of hemlock and cedar swamp, this little grove survived the conflagration that swept through Michigan more than 100 years ago, feeding on the slash left behind by loggers. 50 years later, this sanctuary of old-growth forest became one of my father's favorite spots on the property he purchased before I was born. Now my brother serves as caretaker. And the oldest generation alive to visit the grave is our own. Aldo Leopold wrote of trees to remember in a speech he delivered at the dedication of a monument in Wisconsin, commemorating the extinct passenger pigeon, which once swept through the Great Lakes states by the billions in their quest for acorns and beechnuts. The author of the classic book, Sand County Almanac, spoke these words in 1947. Men still live who in their youth remember pigeons. Trees still live who in their youth were shaken by a living wind. But a decade hence, only the oldest oaks will remember. And at long last, only the hills will know. Like all inhabitants of the Great Lakes region during the mid-19th century, my great-grandparents probably feasted on passenger pigeons whenever a passing flock touched down for the night or chose to breed in their neighborhood, whenever nearby trees were thus shaken by a living wind. In 1999, I joined with other wilderness enthusiasts in the dedication of the Aldo Leopold Amphitheater at the U.S. Forest Service Center at the edge of the Gila Wilderness. The dedication marked the 75th anniversary of governmental protection of the surrounding canyons and mountains in southwestern New Mexico. The event had national significance because the Gila was the first designated wilderness in my country. Aldo Leopold was at that time the forest ranger for the district, and it was he who conceived of and then pressed for these wildlands to remain unlogged, unmined, undeveloped, roadless forever. Many of the junipers and some of the ponderosa pines within my gaze as I write were alive when Leopold was human caretaker for their realm. But do they remember his presence? Surely not. Similarly, the white pines in Michigan do not remember my father. The only oaks who truly remember the passenger pigeon are those still bearing the stubs of branches shorn by the aggregate weight of a thousand birds. Remembering is, rather, an imaginative projection by me that enriches my own awareness of the past. Nevertheless, there are trees who do, in fact, truly remember former times. I know that the cottonwoods, sprouting in a particular spot along a nearby stretch of the Gila River, actually do remember a time before the Great Flood of 1978. Although I have lived in the Gila watershed for only a dozen years, a pre-flood memory is shared with me whenever I stand in the presence of these special trees. Cottonwood trees can sprout from seed only in a floodplain. Yet along this cliff, I find saplings of narrow-leaf cottonwood poking through bedrock 2, even 4 meters above the current level of the river. Although only a few centimeters in diameter, these trees are not as young as they look. They may easily be 100, 200, even 300 years old. All are sprouting from the roots of a large cottonwood tree I've never seen. But that I know must have been here before a flood excavated a much lower channel. The tree never died. The roots have been sprouting ever since, although the sprouts have periodically been mowed down by beavers. If the old rootstock has maintained sufficient contact with the waters, these trees may grow beyond the sapling stage. Encircled by cloaks of chicken wire I have given them, There are trees in my neighbor's horse pasture with far more ancient memories than the cottonwoods. These memories are 10,000 years old. They date back to the Ice Age, when the great mammals of the Pleistocene epoch still roamed this continent. 10,000 years ago, however, the mammoths, the mastodons, giant ground sloths, and the big predators and scavengers that fed upon them all became extinct. Thanks to the work of paleontologists, we humans can remember the Pleistocene mammals. But our memories are acquired through cultural teaching. We are not born with them. Honey Locust, Letitia Triacanthos, Honey Locust is born with the memory. 10,000 years have passed, yet Honey Locust still remembers. Every summer, the tree who remembers the mammoths grows bean-like pods as long as my lower arm and filled with a mixture of pulp sweet enough to attract and seeds tough enough to resist the Ice Age elephants and their grinding molars. Every autumn, Honey Locust expects the mammoths to return. She, Gladitzia, is a dioecious species. She expects to feel her pods plucked one by one by a proboscidean trunk slithering through her branches. But the trunk does not come. Months pass. Well into winter, Honey Locust gives up and drops her fruits. There they lie forlorn, vulnerable to the gnawing teeth of seed predators or the decomposing skills of fungal hyphae. Ten thousand years have passed, and Honey Locust is still clueless that the mammoths are gone. Until very recently, her range had been shrinking, owing to an inability to disperse seeds, as she once had in the rich dung of hot-blooded beef. But then industrial humans came on the scene, finding her wood good for making fence posts, and her foliage good fodder. And so she was planted on farms and ranches. Within the past three decades, she's been groomed for a new livelihood as a street tree. Rather, he's been turned into a street tree because pods are a nuisance in New York City. Both he and she have been stripped of their spines through selective breeding. Three-pronged spines longer than my fingers once defended the trunk and lower branches from bark-stripping tusks. But now all cultivars have been stripped of this fierce memory. Not long ago, I was thrilled whenever I encountered Honey Locust along the sidewalk or parking lot. But now the thrill is tempered by sadness as I realize that the tree is a shell of its former self. Like an old friend with Alzheimer's disease, the honey locusts I encounter in cities throughout the United States are almost always sans memory. Podless and spineless, cultivated honey locusts no longer remember the mammoths. A few weeks after the Aldo Leopold Amphitheater was dedicated, I traveled to the Black Hills region of South Dakota to present a eulogy at a most unusual memorial service. In my guise as MC, I began by reading from Leopold's passenger pigeon essay as his tribute to the bird that had once darkened American skies was the only precedent I could find for our own event. We were conducting a mammoth memorial service at the site of the greatest accumulation of intact mammoth bones in the Western Hemisphere. The we included the paleontologist in charge of excavation and the manager and staff who ensure that the public has a chance to experience the natural wonder without impinging on its scientific value. After two eulogists had paid tribute to the mammoths, it was my turn to do the same. Transformed by a headdress of long, curly pods, crowned with formidable spines, I began my eulogy. I am Honey Locust, Gladitzia triacanthus, and I have to tell you that I'm shocked. I'm absolutely shocked that the mammoths are no longer with us. Until I received an invitation to present this eulogy, I had no idea the mammoths were gone. 10 minutes of extolling the virtues of mammoths passed, and then Honey Locust concluded. Let's remember the mammoths together. You humans and us Honey Locusts, we'd make a good team, don't you think? Rumble on, mighty mammoths, across the grassy plains of our imaginations. Honey Locust thus remembers the greatest beast of the Pleistocene. And knowing her story, we humans can conjure the ghosts of evolution when in her presence. I do that every time I walk to the store during the part of the year that I live in my urban home, New York City. Honey Locust, half of which bear pods, as these trees were planted before the spineless cultivar became podless, Honey Locusts are everywhere, and so too are the ghosts of mammoths. When in the right frame of mind, I can see a Pleistocene giant rear up onto its hind legs and pluck a pod, even as taxis whiz by, just as modern elephants still do when harvesting pods from legume trees in Africa. Almost as common as Honey Locusts in New York City is the tree whose memories are the most ancient of all. This is Ginkgo, the tree who remembers the dinosaurs. It seems that no animal alive today disperses ginkgo fruit in the wild, and though surely something is dispersing it, at least in a haphazard way during most of the last 65 million years, the fruit itself had evolved to attract small, carrion-feeding dinosaurs. Male ginkgos are preferred as street trees today because rotting ginkgo fruit smells like vomit, hence the theory that only carrion feeders would find it attractive. Nevertheless, some parks and sidewalks in New York are shaded by females that produce prolific fruit. Only because the Jurassic Age tree is virtually indestructible to insects, unappealing to herbivores big and small, and capable, like cottonwood, sprouting from ancient rootstock again and again. Only for these reasons did ginkgo survive for millions of years after its intended seed dispersers had become ghosts. Only because humans in China began to cultivate the tree, the medicinal values of its leaves and seeds, only for this reason was ginkgo, once ranging throughout temperate climates of the northern hemisphere, rescued from oblivion. We humans are now in partnership with ginkgo, as we are with honey locust and countless other trees. Missing their partners in evolution, these trees now depend on us. This understanding of the ghosts of evolution and the ecological roles they once fulfilled is an essential learning in light of the human-caused wave of extinction now taking place. Extinctions not only directly endanger much of the Earth's biological richness, but also, through sundering ecological relationships, it threatens to leave many trees and other organisms bereft of their evolutionary partners, and therefore consigned to a slower, but nonetheless inevitable, decline. Let us avert that sad fate. Let us nurture in a thousand ways the passion and resolve necessary to turn around this extinction crisis. Let us begin to tell the stories of the trees we remember.